You're listening to the USEA official podcast, which takes you behind the scenes of eventing, covering all the big events, professional tips and tricks, interviews, special guests, and the latest USEA eventing news. Welcome to the USEA official podcast, episode 279. And my guest on today's show, we have got a show jumping special for you listeners. We will have a little news update for you later on in the show. But first of all, we are going to be focusing on show jumping. And my guest is a man who is well known, I imagine, to many of you. He has been a top level course designer for many years. He's designed at Carolina Horse Park, the American Eventing Championships, among many others. Welcome to the show, Mark Donovan.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you on. You have had an extraordinary career, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the sort of course designing side of things a little bit later on in the show. But to start things off, let's talk about show jumping more generally, because it's obviously hugely important in eventing and one of the three phases. But its influence, has it changed over the years? Has it got harder? I personally, looking at it, think show jumping has got tougher in the last few years.
Absolutely. I think it's gotten tougher. I mean, just in the last year or two, they've changed the time penalties in jumping. So it's constantly being revamped and changed, and everything from the materials used to the shapes of the jumps, the way the front of the jump is filled in, so the look of the jump, to the technicality of the course has changed, and it continues to change. It's, you know, as you try to keep up with the sport and keep a competition going, the horses that are coming down the tracks are better and better horses. So without doing anything that is detrimental to the average horse, you have to also accommodate the abilities of these very good horses that are coming along. Because if you don't have some penalties, as you know, you don't have a competition. So that's the trick.
You make it sound so easy, but actually that's a really, really tough balancing act, isn't it? Because you've got obviously got to, depending on the level that you are competing at, depending on the level that you're riding at, whatever that level is, it's a case of providing a appropriate challenge to be set for those combinations that's going to be challenging enough without making it impossible or too difficult. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the things that riders can do at home to help prepare themselves for competition. So we are fairly early on in the season recording this. You guys are obviously much further ahead than us in the UK, who haven't even seen a sniff of an event horse yet. But let's talk a bit about what you can do at home before people are gearing up to their first competition, or perhaps they're looking to step up a level. What would you be saying, right, at home? These are some of the things that you can be working on to make sure that you've got them in your toolbox prior to heading out to a competition.
Let's see. Well, the number one thing I would say is to have a tape measure. If you're not jumping the actual height of the fences that you'll be jumping in a competition, you're just setting yourself back a little bit. And I've heard people numerous times comment on the jumps look big in the ring, but you know, they are to the standard. So you maybe at home are jumping things that are lower or don't have as much spread on them. So it's important to get your stats out of the rule book and find out what exactly you'll be jumping when you get to the show. It's always a surprise when you get there and it looks way too big for your horse. But there's a lot of exercises, and the exercises that trainers do with placement poles that help the horse's shape over the top of the jump, because when he has a better shape over the jump, he can use his legs better and has a better chance of jumping it clearly. My favorite exercise is a very simple one of setting up a line of jumps, one line of two jumps, say 72 feet apart, so five strides, ideally, or whatever line you set up, to just set it on a 12-foot stride, and just go back and forth over the line, trotting in and cantering out and cantering in and cantering out, and, you know, do it in five strides, trot in and do it in six strides, canter in and do it in five strides. And the more you do that and you go back and forth through the line, you're really just developing your eye, and it really helps you to know where you are in relationship to the jump, and it helps you learn to adjust your horse in a subtle way so that you're prepared by the time you get to the jump, because your eye will get better at seeing the jump further away. So you say, you know, five strides away and then six strides away. And really, when you get in the ring and you have, what, a minute and a half, you have to get it done pretty quickly. And if you can see where you and your horse are and have a good eye for a jump, it helps enormously.
That's a really good exercise. And I guess to an extent, so the first point being in actually start measuring your fences and almost jumping a little bit bigger at home than you would in a competition. But for that exercise in particular, I guess those fences don't have to be enormous. They can just be a case of popping over simple obstacles, but it is all about getting your eye in for the stride that you're looking for.
Right, right.
Okay, we like that one a lot. And I guess then as well, you're able to really adjust your horse when you get into an arena. If you're on a forward distance, you'll be able to see that and ride accordingly. How would you recommend? So obviously you talked then about, you know, having a minute and a half or whatever that show jumping time allowed is. I guess as you go up the levels, it becomes more important. But would you ever suggest at home sort of wheeling a course and figuring out that meters per minute or that distance speed so that you've got a feel for that in training at home?
Absolutely. And especially today with the competitions being so tight, the scores, you know, a little bit of time can hurt you. So it's really important to know what speed you're traveling at. And I think that's probably the last thing that people focus on in their training. But it is something that you can start doing early on. The speeds are slower for the lower levels. So you have to know how to ride that speed. And then you have to know what it feels like to be going 350 meters a minute. And just so it becomes natural to you and you don't have to really be trying to find it during your course. You already know what it feels like to go that speed. So it's just something to take off your plate when you're going around the course.
Works for going too fast and too slow, because there's no point in racing around if you don't need to. But also, right, you don't want to be picking up time penalties and, costing yourself penalties on the final leaderboard if you don't have to. What about exercises at home that, from sort of any technical questions in a course, either grid work for combinations or I guess dog legs and sort of technical lines, what can you do at home that might replicate some of those questions that you would encounter in a course?
It's funny that you say that. I have people call me often after a competition and ask me what the distance in the combination was, because either their horse found not enough room in there, or, you know, was reaching for the second jump and thought the distance was too long. So that's something that I would suggest also with the tape measure you get at home and set up combinations that you can then move back and forth to different distances, because the combination is a special part of the course, true, and that is a place where there's not a lot of room for error at the last second. So if you can get your horse comfortable with a little bit longer one stride or a little bit shorter, because, you know, sometimes it's coming off of a a sharp turn, and your horse is just backpedaling a little bit anyway. So you jump in there, and there's the second jump is too far away. So you end up adding a stride or chipping in or, you know, doing something that doesn't look good in the photograph when you get them back. But so to set up a standard combination at home of, say, 25 feet, excuse me, for a one stride, and, you know, lengthen it out a little bit, couple inches, we're talking, not feet, and shorten it up a little bit and get your horse and yourself comfortable with seeing different distances. Because when you're up in the air over that first jump and your eye looks at the second and you think, ooh, I'm going to be too close, or that's way far away. You have to be able to adjust for that. And there certainly is not a lot of time.
That's great advice. So is it literally just a couple of inches that you would move it by either way?
Right. Yeah. And you can look in your rule book at the, there are, there's constraints of how, what the distances are for, say, a one stride and a two stride. You know, we'll say you can, it will be between 24 and a half and 26 or whatever it is. And so, you know, you can make combinations that change between those distances, you know, but fit within those distances.
Okay, that's really interesting. So if you've practiced that at home, then listeners, then when you get to it in a competition, you'll be able to react accordingly. I guess when you get to a competition, you're not necessarily going to whip out your tape measure and measure it yourself, but it's about being, I mean, some people might, you never know. There's always somebody. But it is about being able to, I guess, be midair and react accordingly, and for your horse not to get a shock.
Right, exactly.
And when you're designing a course, how do you decide what that distance is going to be? Do you have a style in terms of what you feel jumps better over your courses? Do you react to, you know, they're coming off a really tight turn, so therefore I'm going to make it a little bit shorter, or, you know, there's a little bit of a run downhill, so it's going to be a bit longer. How does that work from you designing that perspective?
Well, I always like to make a line that is, I feel jumpable, and nobody likes to see a horse struggle. So you want to have all horses, you want faults to be accidental or an error, not something because the horse or the rider's capability or this question fell outside of their capability. So I like to take a standard 12-foot distance and my standard strides in between combinations, and only adjust depending on the terrain or the arena or the direction of the fence. So if I had a combination and somehow ended up that it was sort of riding straight out of the in-gate, you know, early on the course, like maybe 3 or 4 AB, and so the horse hasn't been really going yet, I might take a little bit of distance out of that combination because I know the horse is going to have its mind on the in gate, because they all know that's how they get out of there. And it would be unfair to put extra distance in a line like that, because you know the horse is already not helping the rider out because they're wanting to go back. So in that case, I would, you know, take a couple inches off. And then certainly, interestingly enough, if I have a line going downhill, I usually, you would think you would lengthen out the distance. But in fact, I think I always take a little bit off of the line and make it a tiny bit shorter, because going downhill, the horse, it overcompensates for itself, and it doesn't actually lengthen its stride, it shortens its stride. So it helps the horse out a little bit that way.
gives them a little bit more help. Okay, that's really interesting. So what else could people do working at home? They've got their tape measure out. They've measured not only the size of their fences, but the length of their accommodations. They've worked on that. They've used some place poles. Is there anything else at home that, you know, perhaps not everybody has the chance of setting up full courses? So if they're using sort of smaller facilities and they've just got a couple of jumps or, you know, a smaller space, what else could they do that might then help them when they get into the competition ring?
I would say bending lines. And so really, you only need two jumps to school at home. If you can get on and off your horse and move them, or say do one line a day. So today I'm working on the combination. So I have my two jumps set up as a combination. Tomorrow I'm going to work on a line of a five stride line. So you set your two jumps up like that. But the other important line in the course is the bending line. And because it's a bending line, people always say, well, there's lots of different ways to get from one to the other. And you can bend out or hold in on the turn. But it's good to practice all those things and be able to do that too, because it's a little bit different approach to the jump, and you have to do some things that you don't have to do in a straight line. So that's why you hear people all the time say, oh, I love that course, there was a lot of turns and bends. Or they say, you know, oh, that was not my best course, I don't like doing so many bending lines. It's something to consider, and setting that up at home would be really helpful.
Yeah, really beneficial. And if you're comfortable at home, very comfortable at home, then when you're under that little extra bit of pressure, and you see it when you're walking a course, which we'll talk about in more detail in a second, but you feel well equipped to deal with it as well. We, I guess, have touched upon what you look for in when you're designing a course, but just talk us through the process, because I mean, you design courses all the way up through the levels, up to four-star level. What do you do in terms of a course designer? Maybe you have multiple levels at that event that you are designing. How does that process work?
Well, Richard Jeffrey, your fellow neighbor, countryman, was my mentor, and he was a master at taking the track and making other courses out of it, other than your main one that you were designing for. So that's essential to being able to do well at a horse show with multiple classes within the same course and all of that. But to get my basic course that I'm really interested in, and that I need a little inspiration for each time. You try to find some sort of inspiration to like where to start this course, because you want your course to be interesting. You want it to be challenging, but not, you know, ugly and hard. And sometimes I'll look at the ring and think, ooh, I really want the last jump to be here, because there's a patron tent, and then it's heading towards the in gate, and there'll be people standing there, and you know, the last jump can be exciting, especially if the time is tight. So I'm going to start here at the end, and you know, find all my, you have to have so many changes of direction and so many right lead jumps and so many jumps off the left lead, and so you've work it out from there. Or I might see somewhere else at another show, like Chris Barnard would do a line of jumps that had like three jumps in it, like along the side of the ring, a vertical, and then five strides to an oxer, and then five more strides to a vertical. And I'll think, ooh, that was a really interesting line. I want to do that. So I'll start that. I'll put that like across the diagonal on my page. And then I'll just go forward and backward from there and try to find a nice course to work out of it. And then sometimes by the time you're through, you don't have anything that you had originally wanted in your course, but it's still helpful. It's a nice way to do it because you don't want to get complacent and boring. Nobody wants, you know, a boring course. So yeah, I try to keep it fresh.
Keep it interesting. And you mentioned there that, you know, you have to have a certain number of different changes of direction and that kind of thing. Is that a guideline that you adhere to? And when you're designing a course, there are certain sort of criteria that you have to tick?
Yes. All the rule books, like the British rule book and the USCF rule book, the Canadian rule book, they all have their own constraints and rules, but it's usually a minimal. Like, in fact, the US book says every course must have 2 changes of direction, preferably more. But so you can have, I think 3 is ideal. Sometimes 5 is can be really interesting, or it can just seem like you never stop jumping and turning. So you have to make sure that doesn't happen also. But that, you know, the rule is 2. So you can fall between the rule, outside the rules, and do a little bit more.
That's really interesting. So there you go, listeners. That's actually something else that is well worth doing. If you're working on your show jumping ahead of the season, go and read the rule book. I know we mention it regularly on the show. It seems an obvious thing to do. And, you know, you perhaps do for, you know, making sure that you are correctly dressed, et cetera, et cetera. But actually go and look at these sort of things, because then you can say, right, well, am I doing this at home? Am I comfortable with this at home, et cetera, et cetera? And you can make sure that you're training appropriately as to what might be put in front of you.
And if you read it every year, it's like reading a brand new book.
Yes, it is. And do you know what? Read it during the year as well. If in doubt, just keep a copy with you. Make sure you've got it saved as to where you need to go to, so that it's easy to check. Because do you know what? You're better to check than be unsure and fall foul or get a surprise. How do you change your sort of designing, obviously, all the way up the levels? But also, what do you do differently between a long format 3-day event and a short format 1-day event, Mark?
Well, you get a little bit of help with that question also in the rule book.
Okay.
Especially today with, there's recommendations in there about the technicality of the course. So obviously, the lower the level, the less technical you want the course to be. So it makes it easier to figure out the lines. Like it suggests not having 4 strides at training level or below. So now you know everything in your course should be 5 strides. So that's a helpful starting point. So at least you're not, you know, building a course from the start that's really didn't have any hope at all of covering the, serving the purpose that it was meant to. It's that's helpful, but it makes it difficult to have all those levels in your course in the same day, because in order to have a 4-star course, you want technical lines and you want 4 stride lines and you want it to be harder. And it's without completely changing the course throughout the day, you learn little tricks how to make something less technical. For instance, the three jump line I was talking about with Chris that I saw Chris do, you might just take the middle one out and then you have a long 8 stride line or something.
Yeah.
You can do things like that.
Okay, my last question is your top tips as a course designer. People get to their event, they're going in to walk the course. What are the things, that the must-dos, that you think you would love to see people walking the course do when they're tackling one of your tracks, just to
read the course map. Is the number one thing. People don't often read the course map. More and more today, you see it happening, and you see a lot of people reading the course map, but still there are some that don't. And the course map tells you a lot of information, gives you a lot of information, especially since I don't even think it's been a few years. I've been doing this for quite a lot of years, but I don't think it's been actually in the guidelines until a few years ago. But you have to track where you wheeled with a dotted line. Mm-hmm. So if you can see that on the map, and then you can look out on the course and say, oh, in order for me to make the time on this course at 300 meters a minute, which is the class I'm going in, I have to go inside that jump and around that jump. It can help you really set your track and where you want to go, instead of just going in there and starting the course and jumping and then looking for the next jump and not already have made a choice how you were going to get there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, so look at your course map. 100% that is first thing to do when you get to an event. Go and find that before you walk the course. What else is there? What else would you say? Do you know what? Please, please do this. It will really, really stand you in good stead.
Know how you're going to get in and out of the ring, really.
Okay.
Because that's when, you really have to plan coming in, what direction you're going to walk or trot your horse before your bell, what side of the ring you want to go on, and how you're going to do your approach to your first fence. There's people that don't do that. They just come in and stand inside the in gate, and your horse has never seen what's on the other side of that arena ever, even though you have. So it can be like quite a shocker if you don't tour him around the ring and get your horse, take that time. I feel personally that 45 seconds is yours to do with what you want, and take your horse where you want him and trot him if you want him, or walk him if you want to, and get yourself and your horse as comfortable and ready as you can before you even start.
So that is 45 seconds from the bell going, or your starting signal, to you having Correct. To go through the start box, or through the start box, through the timing markers to start your round.
Yes. And that's quite a bit of time.
It is. And actually, that's something else you can do at home, is set your watch 45 seconds, get a feel for that. Because again, when you go into the dressage arena, you have a similar amount of time to before you have to start your test. So get a feel for how long that is at home. Don't feel you've got to immediately start. The only thing I would say is just make note of where those timing points are, and don't cross through them as part of your warm up and start the clock, even though you haven't actually started your round.
Right.
Don't do a Bettina Hoy at Athens 2004.
You can actually go backward through the start after the bell has rung. You just cannot go forward through them.
Okay. That's good to know. That's interesting. Right. So you can go that way. One last question for you, Mark, because it's something I've thought about before, and I know a lot of our listeners will have wondered this at some point. When you're designing a course and you say have a 6-stride line or a 7-stride line or an 8-stride line, anything like that, when do you say to people, should they walk even the longer lines, the longer distances, so that they know it's 8 strides? When should they ride on feel? And when should they know, right, that is 5 strides. I will be riding that on 5 strides. What would be your sort of advice and recommendation on that?
Well, obviously, the more strides that are in the line, the longer you have to make your adjustment. I would say in a straight line of jumps, I would walk it no matter what it was. Okay. On a bending line of jumps, they say 8 strides. You wouldn't walk anything more than 7 or 8 strides, which I think is probably pretty true. But when I build a course, I walk every line. I don't care if it's 12 strides. I do like all 12 strides so that I feel that I've left this jump in a place that really is in a perfect place if it was written that way or yeah. It needed to be. I certainly would not be embarrassed about walking any line that you want, even if everyone else says don't walk more than 7 strides. If you want to do it, you should do it, because okay. It does help. For some people, that works well.
Okay, perfect. That's really good advice. Mark, thank you so much. There is so much in there that I hope listeners will have found really, really useful. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, I'm so grateful that you asked me to, and thank you very much.
Well, we promised you at the start of the show, after we'd spoken to Mark and it's been a show jumping special, that we would get a news update with you. And I'm delighted to welcome onto the show now, Rob Burke. Rob, how is everything with you?
Doing well. The weather's beautiful outside and we're getting out to see the horse more, so that's nice.
Good. You're doing better than us, because the weather in the UK at the moment, it cannot make its mind up. It gave us a taste of spring and now has firmly regressed into winter, which is thoroughly miserable, but never mind. Look, we wanted to kind of address a lot of the discussion that has been going on over the last couple of weeks, in particular the Appendix 3 rule change that was proposed and sort of caused a lot of discussion and a lot of conversation came from it. Can you just give us an update as to sort of what it was all about and where things stand now, so that everybody is up to date on the current situation?
Absolutely. So as of March 11th, the USCA Board of Governors voted to table the rule proposal that really was garnering all the attention from our members and those inside and outside of the sport. They decided to table it after listening to the concerns of the members and realizing a couple of things. They realized that, one, by not having an in-person annual meeting and convention, there was a kind of a loss of an ability to communicate. While they might have put out news articles and magazine articles about this rule proposal, not everybody absorbed them. So to that extent, the board took a step back. They are fully committed to getting through a change to this appendix, and they plan to do so in the next year. However, they also wanted to make sure that, one, it gets right, it's right, and that, two, that it's thoroughly communicated to the membership.
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point, isn't it? That, you know, often things can be spoken about, and it's actually when they all of a sudden come to the forefront, particularly over the last 12 months, it hasn't been a straightforward one, that, you know, the real discussion does happen. And I think it's really important to note at this point that ultimately everybody is on the same side here, because everybody wants to make the sport safer, whether you're a competitor, whether you're an official, a volunteer, everybody is working towards the same aim of making the sport as safe as it possibly can be.
Yeah, no, you're dead on there. And it's, you know, it's pretty universal in the comments that we received. Everybody said, we want to improve safety in the sport. And I have to give a ton of credit and support to our volunteers who serve on many of the committees, including the cross-country safety subcommittee. And I really want to point out the work of Leslie Grant Law, David Voss, John Holling, as well as our entire cross-country safety subcommittee and the Board of Governors. You know, this is not, they don't get paid to do these jobs. They volunteer because, like those that commented, they care. They put hours and hours of time into this and research and dedication. And, you know, I think they deserve a ton of credit for what they're trying to do for the sport on a daily basis. And unfortunately, I think oftentimes they get dragged under the bus when they are the people who care the most about many of these topics. So You know, I just want to make sure that's really clear. And also to point out, you know, at the end of the day, this one proposal that's being withdrawn was just one of four submitted by the USCA and the USCA Board of Governors related to safety. I mean, we're trying to take a holistic view of everything that's going on in the sport. We're trying to figure out how we can advance risk management in the sport in a multitude of different ways. And so, you know, we understand the concerns. At the end of the day, the board genuinely understands the concerns, which is why this is being tabled. But, you know, we just need to be very careful to not just complain and do something when you can.
Yeah, I think it is huge credit to everybody involved, in so much as everybody is looking to make the right strides in the right direction. And actually, I think I read a quote from the USCA Vice President of Competitions, Jonathan Elliott, who we've had on the show before. And actually, he was very much saying that everybody wants to make sure they get it right. It's not going to be perfect because that will never happen, but it's got to be right. And this is the perfect example of people trying to do their best for the sport and absolutely trying to do their best for the sport, but listening to the membership and sort of taking on board, you know, people's view and making sure that, okay, this isn't obviously quite right now, so let's go back, let's readdress it, let's see what else we can do to make sure that when it does go through, that it is in the appropriate way and that everybody is on board with that. And the USCA have worked really, really hard to be transparent, and this podcast is very much one of those sort of platforms. And I think huge credit to everybody, because ultimately the members have a voice, and people are listening to that voice, and everybody can now work together. If anybody is or has had opinions and concerns or ideas, Rob, what can they do in order to sort of put those across? Because ultimately, the sport is run mostly by volunteers trying to do their best. So if anybody sort of thinks, actually, I've got something that I can give here, how can they get involved and how can they get their ideas across?
Sure. So first, I recommend they get involved in their local area. Every area in the country has committees, has an area council that are dedicated to the sport, especially focused there. And they also communicate directly with us at the national side of things. So first and foremost, look at who your area council leaders, reach out and say, hey, I want to get involved. Outside of that as well, if you have a concern, a thought, or want to know what's going on, you can always reach out to your local area board of governor member. Every area has at least one board of governor member representing them to the board of governors. And so a good thing to do is go check in with them every once in a while. Say, hey, you know, I have a concern about this. So those are two really good outlets for those thoughts, concerns. And then also just keep up to speed. You know, we just encourage everybody to read what's put on the website, put news articles. We do our best, like you said, to send e-newsletters pointing specifically to these. If you're a member, please read through the magazine when it comes, and just stay informed, because that's one of the best things. I mean, when at the end of the day, if people are absorbing the communications that are being sent out, then that means they're up to speed and they aren't caught off guard when something like a rule proposal all of a sudden in their mind pops up, even if it's been discussed.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really valid point. And I think ultimately the overriding message is we're all on the same team. Everybody wants the sport to be safer, and it's a case of working together to make that happen. So, fingers crossed, things will move it in that direction over the next sort of coming months and the coming years. But Rob, thank you, because it's really important that, I know we've spoken about many times, you know, transparency is key and communication is key. And, you know, that's massive credit to the membership for raising their voice, but also to the USCA for very much listening and looking to make a plan moving forwards.
Thanks so much, Nicole.
Listeners, we hope you've enjoyed what has been a special episode of the USCA podcast. Big thank you to Mark for his insights into show jumping, but also a big thank you to Rob for coming on and giving us an update as well. We will be back very soon on the USCA official podcast. Thanks for listening.
thanks for listening to the USCA official podcast. If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we would love to hear from you. Get in touch through any of our social media platforms at US Eventing, and don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode.